Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
If you're familiar with the program, you know whenever you hear that song, we're gonna talk about Vietnam, and not because the person coming on likes that song, because I don't know if Daryl Horn does, but I got sensitized to Vietnam, the reality of Vietnam, you know, by watching Apocalypse Now. That was my kind of first really watching Vietnam stuff in the 80s when that movie came out, or the late 70s, early 80s, and that song is prominent in the movie. And that was kind of, you know, that movie's a little bit disturbing. I don't know how accurate it was, but I just remember watching the movie and thinking, you know, I don't really know very much about Vietnam. I remember everything that went on about it, but I don't really know a whole lot about it, which kind of started, you know, when I was in college, me reading about it a little bit. And, you know, now in the Marine Corps, we talk about what it is to fight a peer. Somebody who will close with and try to kill you, not kind of do what we've done the past couple of decades in the Middle East, which is, you know, somebody who we can absolutely annihilate if they decide to lay down conventionally in front of us. We don't hardly lose anybody, if you can imagine that. War where you don't have anybody killed. And then when they dissolve into a counterinsurgency, they don't stand and fight. And so In light of that, us now talking about fighting Russia and China, you know, I kind of like to go back to the last time somebody would close with us and try to kill us. And by my reading, by recollection, it was the fights in the northern part of I Corps in 1967 through 1970. And one of the most and places like Con Tien, places like Dong Ha, places like Khe Sanh. So all those are part of this story. When the North Vietnamese Army up in the northern part of I Corps fought the Marines of the 3rd Marine Division, some of the Special Landing Force units that fought in that as well under the 3rd Division. And I don't know that you can rightly tell that story without starting with the story of Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines. And so it's taken me a while, but lo and behold, somebody introduced me to Daryl Horn, who's a veteran of Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines. Daryl lives in Arkansas. Daryl, first of all, welcome to All Marine Radio, and thank you very much for doing this.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right, Daryl is first of all, before we can do any of this, Daryl, we got to find out about you, all right? So, because being Marines, we're naturally skeptical of everybody, right?
Right.
All right, so first of all, tell us about you. Born and raised where?
I was born in southern Arkansas. Down close to Louisiana, place called Lake Village, and you always pass through there going to Florida if you're going to the beach. But anyway, I was born there, and then early on, I was a baby. I don't even remember. My folks moving from there up to Springdale, and pretty much lived here my whole life except for some school time and some Marine Corps time.
So how so you grow up? How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Well, I never really thought about the Marine Corps too much. I was always willing to serve, but I wasn't one to jump in. You know what I mean?
I do.
And so I had been called three different times to go take my physical. Well, twice, and then they didn't take me. And so I was dating this little gal who I'm still married to. And so we decided, well, I guess they don't need me, so we'll just go ahead and get married. We were married for 2 years. And then Uncle Sam decided that he wanted my services. And so I went down to Little Rock and passed all the, you know, the physicals, tests, and what have you. There was about 50 of us sitting in a room waiting to be assigned to where to go. I had told my wife I'd probably go to Fort Polk, or she could come and visit on the weekend. Well, these high-ranking officers from the Marine Corps come walking in, and they were telling these people, they said, "We need five Marines out here." And I'm thinking, that's not me. But anyway, lo and behold, they started picking, and I was the first one they picked. And I said, whoa, just a minute. I didn't come down here to go in the Marines. So I didn't go in the Army, but you'll get an extra year. I said, okay, I guess I'll be a Marine. And I'm one of those drafted Marines.
The and just so everybody knows, right? I mean, you know, this is the days of the draft, and you got, as Daryl said, you got notified to go down, and that you were part of the lottery, and blah 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 blah. And so you didn't grow up learning about the Marine Corps, wanting to be a Marine your whole life. And because your uncle and your dad and your grandpa and everybody else, you become a Marine because somebody picks you and says you only have to do, what, 3 years instead of four?
No, two instead of three.
Two instead of three.
I was active for two, inactive for four.
Right. So, first of all, congratulations on that deal.
Well, I'm proud of it now. I'm glad, you know, that I did serve in the Marines, and I'm a proud Marine.
Attaboy. The off to Parris Island you go. As you said, or did you come to San Diego?
No, I was what they call a Hollywood Marine.
Well, wait a minute.
They sent me off to San Diego. Yeah.
Aren't you east? Isn't Arkansas east of the Mississippi?
Evidently not.
The am I screwed up? Is my geography that bad? Wait a minute.
Yeah.
There's Mrs.
Everybody that was picked from this area went to San Diego.
Well, that's because Arkansas is west of the Mississippi. There you go. I learned something today. Nice. So you come to San Diego. Give me a couple of memories of your time in San Diego. The Marine Corps, pretty tough place at that time. A lot of the guys, a lot of the guys who ran that were Korean War and World War II veterans. So you had a lot of that experience, and it was not the kindest and gentlest place. What? Give me a couple of memories of your time at MCRD in San Diego.
Well, they gave us good hardcore training. Well, when I got there, these nice Marines welcomed me, and there were four other guys, and they were so nice and greeting us and took us out to, had us to go out to a bus. And when we got on the bus, our world was turned upside down. You know, they were calling us all kinds of names that some of them we'd never heard, and making us sit at attention, and we didn't know what attention was, you know.
Like.
Anyway,
states that last desk would be much earlier. So, for example, my state.
Anyway, the training there was it was tough, and especially tough on, you know, the one thing that Marines don't really care for are married men, and draftees, and older guys. I fit all three categories. So that gave me a hard time, but I chucked it out and I survived. And,
truth be told, I mean, Daryl, I mean, back in that day and age, I mean, Marines couldn't get married, right? I mean, you could not get married without, you know, and I don't know if it was the case, you know, but I mean, you couldn't, you know, Marines came in, they were single, they lived in the barracks, they weren't married.
Oh yeah, they were young tough guys ready for war.
Right.
And. Then this old married Marine comes in.
That's funny.
They kind of picked on me, but I held up all right. And they toughened me up and got me ready for Vietnam, I guess.
So you leave, you graduate from boot camp, and what did your train? Did you go to the School of Infantry at Camp Pendleton at the time? What training did you get before you went to Vietnam?
I trained in 81 millimeter mortars. I was 0341, and I trained in 81s in Pendleton, and then also went from there to Camp Lejeune for some more training there, and. Then I was shipped off to Cuba, Guantanamo Bay, where I was still in 81s. We had 81s there, and we didn't do a whole lot with it. We were guarding the defense line and making sure the Cubans didn't come over,
right.
Which we really didn't. We really didn't need to be there because if they tried to come over, they got shot from their side or stepped on a mine on their side before they got to our side, before the mines were. But anyway, I spent 5.5 months there, and I had taken my wife to Camp Lejeune with me, and we were there for like, I think, 2 months before they shipped me off to Cuba. And then when I came back to Cuba, from Cuba, I went back and got her and brought her back again to there in Camp Lejeune. And then I got orders for Vietnam, and they told me at the time I didn't have enough time to go to Vietnam because I only had 12 months left, and the Marine Corps tour is 13 months. Well, I said, that's fine with me. Where am I going? And they saw probably Ireland or something like that. I said, that's great. Can I take my wife? And said, yeah, that's fine. Well, when I got my orders, I was anxious to read it. When I opened it up, it said, Vietnam. So I had to send her back home again.
Well, how did they send you to Vietnam if you only had 12 months left?
Well, I guess they changed the rules.
Yeah, well they'll do that. That's for sure.
Oh yeah. And so that was anyway when I got to Vietnam, I informed them that I was in 81 millimeter mortars. They said, we don't need any. I said, you'll be in the 60s. So what I tell everybody, I was just a heavy duty grunt because, you know, 60s are small.
And
we go with the company and the platoons wherever they go.
Right.
Carry a heavier load.
Right. So you had to be pretty, you know, the Marines that get sent to guard duty, those are pretty high-end Marines. They don't send just anybody to that. And being a mortarman, that's for the as the argument grows in the grunts, right, Daryl? The mortarmen, they're the smart guys, okay? Right? Everybody else,
oh, sure.
Not so much, right? Everybody else, not so much. But so you must have been a smart guy. So you had all the cards going against you. You were older, you were married, you were a draftee. And you were smart.
That's right. I don't know about the smart part, but the rest of it was correct.
talk to me about going to Vietnam at that time. You go, and again, everybody, as opposed to the way we do it now, everybody goes as an individual, right? And would you flew to Okinawa first?
Yeah, they flew me to Okinawa, and actually, I spent a month in Okinawa, and every day. We'd fall out, and they'd decide he was going to Vietnam. And every day, I didn't get picked for a month. And finally, it was my turn. And so we went to the airport to get on the plane. It was C-130.
Right.
And they said, well, y'all have to wait till we unload. And so we were waiting. Well, guess what they were unloading? Body bag.
Yeah, I knew. I knew you were going to say that. So you're standing on the tarmac. Yeah. You're standing at the tarmac where? At Kadena Airfield?
Yeah, right there. Yeah, in Okinawa.
Right.
And so it made me face reality at that point. I'm thinking, well, we can come back just like that, you know, in those bags. But and then when we got on the plane, it still didn't smell very good. But then they dropped us in San Diego and then transferred us from San Diego out to Dong Ha, which is...
Wait, hold on. Where's San Diego?
Oh, did I say San Diego? No. I meant Da Nang. I'm sorry.
I know. People get them confused all the time. Da Nang, San Diego, what the hell?
I know. Make all those places. But anyway, and then they transferred us out to a place called Dong Ha, which is, at the time, there wasn't much to it. It was more or less tents. And then they didn't take us all the way, dropped us out. I don't know, a couple of miles from where we were supposed to go. So we were pumping out and didn't even have our equipment yet. And that night, it was dark.
Wait, did you have a rifle or anything?
No.
No?
We were issued when we got to Dong Ha.
Okay.
And, yeah. And so, but that first night, well, when we landed, I'll tell you about the landing. I thought we'd crash because, you know, they lay out these metal strips.
Right.
Pieced together. And when you land on those, it's rough as a cob. And I thought for sure we'd crash because we were falling out of our seats and everything. And then we spent the night in a bunker listening to all the firing and the bombs and wondering what was going on. They told us we couldn't have any light. We couldn't, you know. And next morning's when we went to Dong Ha. And we got there. And all these guys were all raggedy, dirty looking, you know. And here we are in our new fatigues and utilities. And we looked like the new guys for sure. And there were a group of Marines sitting around with a big chunk of ice. They were chipping off of that ice. And so they invited us over. There was about, I think, five of us maybe. And so we got over and we were eating the ice. And I'm thinking, where did they get this ice? They probably got it out of, you know, a mud hole somewhere. But they'd bought it from the Vietnamese.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Anyway, we spent a little bit of time there and then we got our orders and issued everything. And then it came time for the first day out in the field. Well, our first day we'd been out probably till about noon. We were crossing an open area and we got bombed by 81 millimeter mortars, which just happened to be our own people. They got mixed up thinking we were the enemy. So that was my first experience of the war. No one was hurt, thank the Lord, but it was an interesting time, scary time.
Hey, Daryl, I want to ask you a question. The experience for Vietnam era Marines and I would imagine Army soldiers for that matter is very different from the one that that Marines experience today when they go, we go to fight. We go as a unit, we come back as a unit, right? So
right.
You go there and they're already a tight organization and you know, Marines read about being the FNG, right? The fucking new guy, right? Your utilities are different. You don't know. I was reading something talked about, a guy telling us his story, and he said, the first day I got there, I walked point on my first patrol. And, their attitude was that, hey, you had to earn your keep. They had done it. You were going to do it and get out there. And a lot of guys didn't want to get to know you because the odds of you surviving were not great. I mean, did you experience that? I mean, thank God you were older, but I can't even, that's a pretty full cup for an 18-year-old, a 19-year-old young guy.
It is. And it takes a while to get hardened to that because you do see that. And guys are getting wounded and killed pretty much daily. And so it was a very difficult time. And like you say, we were just more or less singly dropped into a company. You know, here you are. And you don't know anybody. You don't know anything, actually. You think you might because you've been training. You know, went through Vietnam training school out in California before I went over.
Right.
But for me, it was a lot different. We trained in jungle warfare. When I got there, I was up around the north. So we were fighting the North Vietnam Army. And it was a little bit different than from what I'd expected. Of course, I don't know. It probably wasn't any worse than the other, but it was different.
Right, it was different. No, you see pictures. Yeah. You see pictures of Con Tien, and the area around it, and it's not what most people. If you close your eyes and say, "Okay, tell me what Vietnam looks like," it's not what you would picture in the vicinity of Northern I Corps, which is a little bit different terrain and the enemy certainly very different. What are your earliest memories of being new and heading out there on patrol?
Yeah, well, as I went in, I was looking out the window of the airplane, and I'm thinking this is like a vacation paradise, you know, with all the oriental trees and stuff that you see. But then as we got closer and a closer look, you can see all the holes in the ground where the bombs had been dropped. But, it was a pretty scary thing to be dropped into that and not really knowing. You know, and like you say, at Con Tien, it was just a big, dirty, muddy hill. Actually, I think there were three hills in one there.
Right.
But
now that you say that, let me. I just want to point something out with the battle study that you're listening to. There's a map that's included in it. So if you go into the post that you see on the web. And you check it out, you'll see an image, and it's really one that I pulled off Google Earth, and then I kind of superimposed the layout of the base at Con Tien over the top of that, and then so you'll see the three hills that Daryl's talking about are OP 1, 2, and 3, and then you'll see where the 19CP was. And then you'll see where the all the different things when you read about Con Tien, where the 105s were, where the LZ was, where the 4.2 mortars were, where the 81s were, where Daryl maybe at one point should have been, but that was not to be his fate. So you'll see kind of where everything is. Daryl, I mean, and you had to own that piece of ground. Because that piece of ground dominated Dong Ha, right? You could see Dong Ha from Con Tien, and so you know anybody who owned that ground, you know, could lay waste to Dong Ha.
Oh yeah, it was a pretty hot spot because the NVA really wanted it bad, and so they were bombarding that place constantly, and. I was fortunate. I spent three different times there.
Wow! What and again, I just you're a mortarman. So for everybody out there, imagine this, right? You have the DMZ North of Con Tien, you have the North Vietnamese artillery and mortars north of the Ben Hai River, dug in or in caves, and they have the data on their guns, right? From refined by years, okay. I mean, if you can imagine that, like he's standing where? Oh, okay, that's this, right? That's this gun data. I mean, that's how. And we could not locate the guns, and even if we could, they were underground, they were in caves, and so you went there and you just got hammered, right?
You did. We tried to pinpoint where they were, and we could once in a while, and we would fire in the direction that we were hearing and possibly seeing smoke, and once in a while we'd get a secondary explosion, which was very exciting because we knew that we had gotten that position.
Wow.
Because once you hit it a few times, you get their ammo down.
Right.
And you get that secondary. It's pretty exciting. So what we would run out, we'd go out in our bunker, we would fire in those areas, and then we'd run back in our bunker because we knew it was coming back at us. And You know, at one time there, we went 23 days of constant bombing and firing. And, I mean, we were just going crazy because all we could do is run out, fire up, fire, and then run back in. And one day I was so fed up. I said, guys, I'm stinking. I got to clean up. And so we had a big mud hole out in front of our bunker. So I went out and dipped my helmet in it, went back behind the bunker and set me up. I was going to shave and bathe and all that. And then I heard the boop, 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 you know, again, here they come. So I ran back in the bunker. And then when there was a little lag time, I went out to get my stuff and there was nothing there. So, it was going on all the time.
No, you know, and
we had choppers coming in, taking out the dead and the wounded. And whenever they came in, it got worse. Right. So they'd pinpoint on them, right. You know.
Right. So to me, if you can imagine, as Daryl kind of describes the story, you come to, you know, the way the Marine Corps did it, you come by yourself and you're young. You know, here's the old man at the age of 23, right? And the guy that was older than him is Grandpa, for God's sakes. And you come to this place that's just getting hammered. You have to do your year there. And so you have this kind of, we're not there together as a unit. I'm here with this unit, but I'm, you know, I'm here trying to get to my days. And you're not free to go north into the DMZ and take these guys on, Daryl, right? You've got to stay, you know, you got to stay south of the DMZ because we're not doing that. And it would seem to me that there would be a fair amount of frustration that we're here killing them, right? And, you know, we're here hopefully until we get to go home, maybe until we die. And this doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Was there a lot of discussion about that? Is that something you guys talked about, just the frustrating nature, or did you just kind of try to ignore it because that was just the way that it was?
Well, you know, we did talk about it often, and it was a sticky situation. But you just finally have to adapt to it and say, well, I'm here. I've got to do my part, you know, and hopefully I'll get through it. And some of us did. 58,000 did not.
Got it.
But
it just the more you read about it, the more it's just like, wow, that was, I mean, going to war is hard no matter when you go.
It is.
And that, what you describe, what people describe is about Kantian is amazing in terms of, you know, how much young guys had on their plate and the different decisions, you know, because you would get guys, I mean, I the stories that you read, I don't want you to comment on this, but you know, Daryl, you're supposed to go and lead an ambush patrol, but you've only got 2 months left, right? And these ambush patrols have been going on for a long time and they're going to go on forever. As far as you're concerned. So you know what? I'm not going to go out and do that. We'll go out 100 meters beyond our line or someplace that I know is defensible, and then we're going to set up a little 360, and we're going to go to sleep. Right? Or an OP that was supposed to be one place but got put another place because I know I can live here. And so it wasn't the easiest time relative to leadership in the Marine Corps.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, so many times you go out at night, and it's hard to tell where you were, even though you had a map and compass. And that was a funny thing. When I got there, I told my wife, she knew that I have trouble finding my way around town. And she was worried. I said, don't worry about it. I'm in 81, so I'll be back behind everybody, you know, helping them out. And when I got there, they put me in 60s, gave me a compass and a map. And I thought, oh no, here I have a lighter. I'm in the bush. I'm having to plot directions and plot firings. But it worked out. You know, over there it's a little different from in the States where you have roads and streets. Over there you got mountains and trees and rivers, you know, stuff like that. Completely different.
And if you're lucky, a wide trail.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they better stay off the trails, though. They're booby trapped.
Right. So, when do you arrive?
What's what?
When? What day? What month do you arrive, Daryl?
I arrived in Vietnam on June 2nd. I was just going to say I was there a month when we got ambushed and lost pretty much our whole company.
I want to talk about and let me tell you things we're going to talk about. Daryl's an interesting guy because, you know, he's written a book, and we're going to talk about that. I want to talk about his motivation for writing the book. You know, what he went through when he came home. You know, because a lot of Vietnam vets, I mean, they didn't go there, right? But Daryl's talked about he's different. I mean, he had his family around him. He was already married. He's a man of faith, and so that's an important part of the story. So let's talk about Operation Buffalo, Daryl. Before we talk about it, is there anything we need to know, in your opinion, about what was going on at Contien at the time or the way Contien worked? There was normally two companies inside the firm base and the other two were out operating, is my understanding from reading. Is there anything we need to know before we talk about Operation Buffalo?
No, we had been at Contien probably, maybe a couple of weeks. And they decided we were going to go out on Operation Buffalo. And as far as Contien, it was just really a hot spot. Guys had their job to do. I remember when I first went in, we were going up the side of the hill. And mud, you couldn't hardly walk. You tried to pull your boots off. It was so bad. I mean, it wasn't a nice place to be, and it had several nicknames, you know, like, time in the barrel.
Right.
You feel like you're in a barrel with somebody hitting it with a ball bat. Hill of Angels, because so many had died there. And they just had all kinds of names for it. But anyway, they had informed us that there was a 5th battalion of the NVA out in the area where we were supposed to go on Operation Buffalo, but that we possibly wouldn't see any of them. Well, that scared the crap out of me because I'm thinking, we're 150 guys going out looking for, 5,000. But anyway, and like to say, I'm a man of faith, and I was praying and asking the good Lord to take care of us, protect us.
Let me ask you about that, Daryl. I mean, you'd been there. If you'd been there for 30 days, you'd been there long enough to know that, you know, you've seen a lot of you've seen guys who go to church who get killed, and you see guys who don't go to church and don't pray, they don't get touched. How did that affect you?
Well, you know, it was a hard thing because you're thinking, why did that happen? You know, and I felt that the good Lord was looking out for me, most part. And there was a time or two that I kind of questioned it because things wasn't going too good. But I did have faith, and I had a wife and family and a church all praying for me while I was there, which I think made a big difference for my protection. But as far as the other guys, it was difficult. Seeing them, the ones that died, like you say, some knew Christ, some didn't. Well, you know, they say there's no atheists in foxholes.
Right.
Well, I think that's partially true. I didn't know of any. There may have been some, but I didn't know of any. Anyway, it was difficult for everybody that was there.
So you'd been there a month. So you're working 60 millimeter mortars for the company,
right?
And what were you doing? Were you Were you the team leader? Were you the? Were you humping ammo? Were you working on the FTC? What were you doing relative to the 60s?
At that point, I was a gunner, 60 millimeter gunner, and so I had a 45 pistol, and I carried the tube and the base plate.
Got it.
And we would set it up as and use it as we went. And then we only had two at that time. And so we had about eight guys, you know, four per. And we were promised another one, which never did happen. But they kept saying they were gonna get us another tube. And we finally ended up down to one because we lost one during Operation Buffalo. But and we would be assigned to a we'd go with the company, but we would be with the first, second, or third group, you know.
Right.
And so they switch around, assign us to different ones each time we went out. And so this particular time we were attached to second battalion.
Second platoon?
Yeah. Or second platoon. I mean, let's see. Let me think a second. we were attached to third platoon. Yeah, that's right.
So let me ask you, you know, so normally in this area with the North Vietnamese, when you guys go out and operate, what are you doing for the most part, Daryl? Are you moving? Are you patrolling, looking for them, and they're ambushing you? I would tell you that in Iraq and Afghanistan, the majority of times Marines are out patrolling, doing whatever they're doing, and the insurgents in either place, you know, initiated 90% of the contact. They tried to spring an ambush, and Marines would fight out of that. How did that stuff normally happen? You know, in the month that you experienced leading up to the events that start really on the 1st of July.
Well, we would go out either as a full company or as a platoon. Usually, we would end up with the company and be attached to one of the platoons. And we would settle in. We would do a search and destroy, you know, destroy bunkers and things that we'd find along the way, looking for the enemy. And, it's kind of a cat and mouse game. We look for them in the day, they look for us in the night. But anyway, we would go out and we would send out squads, you know, for ambush squads during the night, and usually we would set up somewhere nearby as support for the ambush squads, and so we'd go up and find a place. We'd stay there for maybe a day or two, not too long, because we didn't want to be pinpointed.
Right.
And like I say, we were looking for stuff all the time. We were searching and destroying whatever we could find.
Got it. Now, would your mortar tube set up with the company CP, and the platoons would be moving, and you might be supporting them, or did you guys move with one platoon? How did that work?
We just moved with one platoon, which one was assigned to. Wherever they went, that's where we went. And we were their support, and wherever they were, we knew where they were, and we got applauded. And when they needed us, we were there. The good thing about being in mortars, we didn't have to go out on the ambush squads. But we weren't far away. We were close enough for support. And it was kind of hairy at times, you know, because at night you're just sitting there waiting, you're looking, and the trees are moving, and the bushes are, you know, blowing, and you're thinking, who's there? And
right.
Can they see me? I can't see them, and, you know.
All that.
You feel like a sitting duck.
Right. Hey, Daryl, I mean, talk to us about the NVA and how they would attack you, because, you know, when you read about them, I've only found one book written by an NBA soldier, which was really interesting. And he said, look, we had to be really good in the field. We had to be good at camouflage because, because if they caught us with their firepower, we would all be dead. And we all knew that. And if we didn't get close to them and fight them close and then break contact and run, you know, they would drop that napalm on us and you'd see most of your unit on fire. And he said and that had happened to him a couple times and he was lucky enough to survive. But how did they attack you? Would they mortar you, machine gun you, and then come attack you? Or would they just was it you guys trying to ambush each other? How did they normally attack you? Or could you explain that to us?
Well, yeah, they were pretty good at ambushing, but you know, like the NBA had big time stuff. Like when we went out, they set up for us. They knew we were there. We didn't know where they were. The night that we set up camp, we could hear them firing mortars, and we were thinking and rockets, and we were thinking, oh, they think we're over there. Well, they didn't think we were over there. They thought that's where we were going. And so the next day, they had a nice sized U-shaped ambush. And when you get that many, I mean, there were like probably 5,000, and they were in spider holes, they were in trees, they were in tunnels. I mean, they're good. They're good at camouflaging, like you say, and we just more or less walked into the area where they had planned that we would go, and so. Sorry, we had an accident here.
Still on? Yeah, no, we're still on. Just for everybody, my guest today is Daryl Horn. He was a mortarman in Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines during Operation Buffalo. We've been talking about Contien, and so you're getting a perspective from – were you a PFC, Lance Corporal, Daryl? What were you when you went to Vietnam?
I was a Lance Corporal.
From the backbone of the backbone of the Marine Corps right there. And so you're getting that perspective – of what it was like to be up there at Contien. All right, so I just want to kind of paint that picture, you know, before the events of Operation Buffalo. So tell us about Operation Buffalo. You guys, the two platoons that had been out, and this is my reading of history, but they had been in generally the same area the week before you guys went out there. And I read that normally it was not the custom to go right back into the same place. That, okay, we've checkerboarded those two squares. Now we're going to move over here. But you guys went right back into the same place. Was there any feeling that you guys were going to make contact this time relative? And you'd only been there a month. But was there any conversation that this was going to be different than anything else?
Well, I think we all pretty much had the feeling that we would probably make contact at some point. We just didn't know how severe it was going to be. And surprisingly enough, it did happen. I was pretty scared going out because, like I said, I was thinking we would be so outnumbered if we ran onto them.
Right.
And which we did. But, yeah, you know, at that point you're pretty much doing what you're told to do.
Right.
And so we were assuming and hoping that our superiors knew, you know, what they were doing.
So and, so you guys head out the 30th of June, and then you head essentially southeast. And then on 1 July, you start heading north up that road. What do they call it? 571 or something like that. That takes you to the market.
Right. Yeah.
So you head you're heading north. you spend the night of 1-2 July, the night of the 1st of July, a little bit south of the area that's called the market. And had you guys seen any indications up to that point that there was anything in front of you? Had you seen anything like that?
We came up on one of the villages, and we were thinking they were there. So we sent a squad up to check it out, and we were waiting to see what they came back with. And a funny story, during that time, we were in the elephant grass, just kind of waiting, sweating and being dirty. And
okay, and, hold on, Darryl. Explain to everybody what elephant grass is.
Well, it's just real heavy grass. It's more, honestly, I don't know. It's thick and it's sharp. As you walk through it, it tears your clothes and cuts your hand or whatever you happen to pass it. And it just grows, and it's real tough. We call it grass. It's more like big weeds, you know.
Okay. And when you say big, how tall would it be? Would it be 3 feet tall, 6 feet tall? Did it depend?
Oh, yeah, it depended. It could be 3 or 4 feet tall. And this particular day, I think, was probably maybe 2 feet. And I experienced something moving in the grass while we were waiting. And we had been told not to fire at anything, not make any movements. Well, I looked up and I seen this grass moving, and pretty soon I seen the head of a big old snake sticking up out of it, like it almost standing up. And I'm thinking, that thing's got to be 8 or 9 feet long. And he looked around, and it's almost like he's fixing his eyes on me, and here he came. And he got, I don't know, within 10 feet or so. And I was ready. I had my bayonet out. I was going to see what I could do. And he got that close, and then he just turned and went the other way. And I'm thinking, whew, I'm sure glad that happened that way.
Yeah, probably all that Arkansas Razorback mystique probably scared him off.
Yeah, something did. I don't know what. Or he felt sorry for me.
There you go. Like, this guy's got enough on his plate. Let me leave him alone. Hey, before we get into the events of the 1st and the 2nd, talk to us about the heat, because – most Americans don't understand the kind of heat and humidity that you guys fought in on a daily basis. Talk to us about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, the heat was unbearable. The humidity was high, and it's probably kind of like you experienced. But it was just always really hot, and the sun was piercing. And, you would be moving most of the day, and then at night when you tried to settle in a little bit, you're soaking wet with sweat, and then you get a little breeze and you start shaking. You're freezing, and it's probably 70 degrees or 80, but it chills you. But anytime we stop, we try to shield ourselves from the sun. We had ponchos, poncho liners. Matter of fact, that's all I carried the whole time, that was my bed. But anyway, we'd try to find a shaded spot, which there weren't that many normally. But the sun was piercing, and the temperature was probably anywhere 100, 115, 120 degrees constantly, except for the monsoon, and then it's just constant raining all the time. So the weather is. It's pretty unbearable. I don't know how those people stay over there. But
and now, are you wet the whole time? Are your boots soaked all the whole time? Or whether it's from rain or your utilities, are you pretty much wet the whole time?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you dry out during the day, but during the monsoon, yeah, you're just wet all the time. And I had a friend tell me, he just came back from Vietnam when I was going, and he said, well, when it starts raining, just put all your stuff, roll all stuff out, and let it get soaked. It's going to be that way for months. And but I didn't have to. You don't have to do that. You're going to get it soaked anyway. And we wasn't in any place long enough to really set up good protective tents or anything. We were just pretty much moving every day or every other day. And I mean, everybody wasn't doing that, but our group was. And so, yeah, you stay wet and you get all wrinkled up. You know how you stay in the bathtub too long and your skin starts wrinkling?
Right.
That's the way you were. Yeah.
And so so things that Marines will see in pictures are the bug juice that you guys used to have in your helmet line, in that helmet band. And
right.
And they'll also see everybody had seem – a lot of people seem to have a towel around their neck.
Yeah. I never had a towel, and I didn't like the bug juice.
Did it work? Let me tell you. I'll tell you a story about the bug juice. That was still around in the 80s. And I remember I had a fanny pack, right, that you put on the back of your cartridge belt. And my bug juice leaked, and it stripped all the paint off the cami stick, right? You know, the cami stick came in those metal containers.
Yeah.
Right? And I looked, and there was no paint.
Stuff.
Yeah, there was no paint. There was no paint on a damn thing. And I said, that shit just pulled the paint off metal, and I'm going to put it on my skin? Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That's the last time I ever did that. Last time I ever did that. No, I just, I mean, so I want people to, like, when they think about this, you're fighting somebody who's going to come close with you, you know, and it's over 100 degrees. It's over 100% humidity, right? It's raining all the time. And in the midst of this, you're going to go out and you're going to look for them. And then on your downtime, when you come back to Contien, you're going to get the shit shelled out of you. Right, and then you're gonna peel sandbags and dig trenches and all the rest of that stuff.
Oh yeah, we were doing that constantly because we were always going to put another layer on top of the bunker, try to fix it where to take a direct hit, you know. And we didn't get a direct hit, but we got hit awful close many times. But we use, you know, our mortars come in boxes or mortar rounds,
right?
So we'd fill those boxes with dirt and stack them, and then we'd fill sandbags, stack on top of them, and, you know, we'd have three or four layers.
Yeah, no, we've all seen the pictures. The one other thing you guys dealt with was that thing that you know, a lot of people, when they see it, they're like, what? And it's called the trace or the fire break or McNamara's line. Can you describe that to everybody? Because that's one of the unique features of what was around Contien, which was this fire break that got built that was going to help us win the war.
Right. Yeah. They worked on that for months and months, and they were going to dig a bare strip, to where the enemy could be detected. They were even going to have lookout towers posted on it and fences and the whole work. And but you know what? It never got finished. It just ended up being a dividing line. It didn't have any protective stuff at all. It was just an open area where they cleaned all the trees and junk. We were close to that strip many times on our patrols. And it didn't keep anybody out, for sure.
And just for the record, Daryl, my last name's McNamara, no relation, okay? All right, so,
oh, okay.
so just for the record, I do not trace my lineage to that dude. We're going to stop right here, and if it's all right with you, this is going to be part one, and in part two, we'll pick up on the morning of July 2nd, you guys spend the night just south of the marketplace, and you guys head north, and that will be a day that certainly changes your life, a day written in Marine Corps history. If you don't mind, we'll talk about that. But first of all, absolutely wonderful talking with you about your time in the Marine Corps, and I want to just thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been enjoyable.
All right. Daryl Horn, right? The old man, as he was known, 23 years old in Vietnam, an 0341 mortarman with Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. How cool is that? Yeah, honestly. Just a great guy. And, in that hour, what I wanted to do was just paint a picture for somebody who's never been to Vietnam and didn't really understand the fucked up way that we did Vietnam and the situation that Marines in Leatherneck Square found themselves. You're within range of artillery and mortars from just north of the Benhai River in the demilitarized zone. Those guns are dug in. You can't get to them. and they've been spotting rounds impact you for years now. That's how refined the data is. And so you live under that on a daily basis. And you're going to fight a guy who's really good in the field and is looking for you and is looking to bring it to you. In fact, there's a picture that will go with this post. And you're going to see the fighting position that Daryl digs. And let me tell you, it's a good one. You're going to see him standing. His own fighting position is up to his waist, right? Now, that's for anybody who's dug fighting position, that's serious fighting position. Why is he digging that? Because he knows it'll save his ass. That's why. Because he knows they're serious. So it's not like they're, going to shoot at you and, in an attempt to isolate a 3 or 4 man unit. This is a Marine rifle company. Yeah. It's a Marine rifle company that they're coming after with a battalion or whatever they choose. So anyway, to me, though, it's really important that people to understand Contien, understand a little bit about how young Marines got there. And it was not, I would say, us operating at our optimum level. And so anyway, but again, what just a great guy. And so we will pick up next week as Operation Buffalo commences. And illustrated in the air, right? If your face is Contien and you hold both hands up in front of your face, your right hand as it moves towards the ceiling, that's Bravo Company moving up. I think it's Route 150 or 571 or something like that. And then on your left hand is Alpha Company. And they were headed into the DMZ. And they get it on in what will be the most costly operation for a Marine unit in Vietnam, Operation Buffalo. So we'll talk about that next week. And then hopefully in the third segment, if he's up to it, we'll talk about him coming home. And then years later, close to 40 years later, he decides he's going to write a book. And then how that book has impacted on him and kind of tilt the discussion towards post-traumatic winning. So I love Vietnam veterans. Their stories are always, in my opinion, very humbling to hear because of what they did. And especially these guys who fought in the northern part of I Corps. It was serious shit, man. Against an enemy that would, bring their combined arms against you. And, in my opinion, the last time we really fought somebody like that. So, and then their stories when they came home. What they had to live through. So, I just want to thank Daryl Horn for doing that. And hope you enjoyed it. So, yeah, when you click on this, you will see the maps. You'll see the first map is is the Leatherneck Square area, so you get a sense of where Compton is relative to the DMZ. You'll see another map that is the Compton base. You'll see another map, which is one I made, which is the Compton base superimposed on a Google image, and some graphics on that image that kind of orient you to the fighting that will take place in the first few days of July. So, with that said, have a great Wednesday. Stay busy. Home projects, all the rest of it. Just stay on top of it, because again, I see estimates. You know, people like, you know, the president's talking, and he's always the optimist in chief, right? But to me, you know, the nation's got to let people that should go back to work, got to let them go back to work, right? Everybody is not New York City. And so anyway, so hopefully people people, you know, do the right thing. The other interesting thing that's all over the news is the president cutting funding to the WHO. And I think this is, you know, this is the playbook that got used relative to NATO and them not spending, right? They're not spending what they were obligated by the NATO treaty to spend. And even worse, had no intention of doing it. So the president very publicly, you know, talks about, all right, then if you're not going to live up to your end of it, then we won't live up to ours. So whether you like it or not, this is how he tends to raise issues. And let me tell you what, the World Health Organization has something to answer for, you know, so people can, you know, oppose him politically. And we got that. But they also, if they're going to do that, tell me your plan, right, to deal with a problem that obviously exists. And that is the World Health Organization being China's dancing chicken. That's got to stop. That has got to stop. And Grant Newsham had a very, very simple reason for it. And if you look at the International Olympic Committee and how they do business, if you look at how FIFA does business, that does the World Cup, what governs where the Olympics are going to be? The bribes that get paid. How else in God's name could you even with a straight face say that you're going to play the World Cup of soccer in gutter, where it's 120 on a daily basis? It's ridiculous. What makes it all make sense? You know, bribes. And so, you know, we in the United States, we recoil at that, right? But the rest of the world doesn't. The rest of the world knows that that's the way it goes. If you're gonna do business, you better pay off the appropriate people, or guess what? You ain't doing business. So, and again, Grant's talked about that Mr. Duterte in the Philippines for years has been accused of being on the Chinese dole. So anyway, we shall see. But how, again, you see when Donald Trump says something, this massive backlash against it. But the truth is, the World Health Organization made this pandemic worse. China, by its deliberate actions, not by its ignorance, China, by deliberately misleading the rest of the world with the corroborative help of the World Health Organization. I mean, somebody should answer for that. I mean, in my opinion, if I was the head of Italy, I'd be going to China and say, I want to be financially compensated for what you've done to my country. But it seems like whenever Donald Trump opens his yap, you know, the world responds in a not very positive way. And I will tell you this, sometimes he's right, and he's right about the World Health Organization. Now, do I think the United States is not going to fund the World Health Organization? No, we will. But this is how he raises the issue. And it's an issue that needs to be raised. So anyway, with that said, have a great day. All Marine Radio continues right now.